News, I'm Tommy McNeil. A Dutch-led international team investigating the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines passenger jet over Ukraine in 2014 now names three Russians and a Ukrainian as murder suspects. As AP's Charles de Ledesma reports, prosecutors continue to look up the chain of command for who gave the order to fire on the plane.
The international team investigating the downing of flight MH17, in which 298 people died, will not ask Russia and Ukraine to extradite the four suspects. Prosecutors realize that the constitutions of both countries prohibit that. They are asking Russia to hand the summons to the suspects, who are in the Russian Federation, and arrange for the men to be interviewed about the charges.
That's AP's Charles de Ledesma. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a statement that United States welcomes the announcement regarding the indictment and extends its deepest sympathies to the families of the victims. A UN rights investigator says that there is credible evidence linking the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi last October in Riyadh's consulate in Istanbul. Agnes Callamard, the UN Special on Extrajudicial Execution, said that the Khashoggi incident, or Khashoggi, was the victim of a deliberate premeditated execution, an extrajudicial killing in which the state of Saudi Arabia is responsible under international human rights law.
There is no way the leaders of that state, including the Crown Prince, were not aware of those violations. In fact, there is evidence, credible evidence, pointing to their involvement.
Saudi Arabia has put 11 people on trial for the murder and seeks the death penalty for five of them. This is the VOA News. A Kenyan court has found three terror suspects guilty of the April 2015 Garissa University terror attack, in which nearly 150 people, mainly students, were killed. A magistrate set sentencing for next month. Sarah Kilmani has more from Nairobi.
Three co-defendants were found guilty of conspiracy to commit a terror attack. Chief Magistrate Francis Andayi.
I'm satisfied that the incident that took place at the Garissa University College on the morning of 2nd April 2015 bore all the above elements of a terrorist act.
There was insufficient evidence to link one suspect, Sahal Diri Hussein, to the attackers or any of the accused persons. Sentencing has been set for July the 3rd. The April 2, 2015 attack claimed 148 lives. Several attackers were also killed by security forces in the assault on the school. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN Refugee Agency reports nearly 71 million people around the world are now forcibly displaced by war, persecution, and conflict. As Lisa Schlein reports, the number is the highest level ever reached since the UNHCR was established nearly 70 years ago.
For the fifth consecutive year, the report says Turkey hosted the largest number of refugees, followed by Pakistan, Uganda, Sudan, and Germany. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says an analysis of the statistics shows that wealthy countries do not shoulder the greatest refugee burden.
When you say Europe has a refugee emergency, or the United States or Australia, no. Most of the refugees are, in fact, in the countries next to where the war is. And unfortunately, that means mostly in poor countries or in middle-income countries.
Of the more than 70 million people who were displaced in 2018, the UNHCR reports slightly less than 600,000 refugees were able to return home, while only 92,400 were resettled in third countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Mexican Senate overwhelmingly ratified a new trade deal with Canada and the United States. Despite misgivings from liberals and tensions with the U.S. over immigration, lawmakers passed the measure Wednesday 114-4. Mexico is the first country to approve the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the replacement for the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement. The new agreement is almost identical to the old one. The main differences include the condition that cars exported to the U.S. must contain more U.S. made parts, and U.S. dairy farmers will be able to sell products to Canada. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. More than 70 million people are displaced globally on this World Refugee Day today, Thursday.
When you talk, for instance, of Cameroonian refugees, the reason for which they have run away needs to be solved.
Antonio Joseph is the UNHCR and ECOWAS representative for Nigeria. South Sudan refugee children lead broken families in Uganda refugee camps. Sudan protesters plan to hold night marches to demand civilian rule. Three terrorists have been convicted in Kenya for their role in the 2015 Garissa University attack. And Malawi has re-elected its first female speaker of parliament.
Her name is Catherine Gotani, and she's been voted in to parliament by a fairly narrow margin, but this effectively makes her the third most powerful person in Malawi.
Rafik Hajat is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction in Malawi, and the East African community says three of its officials should be prosecuted for corruption. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today, Thursday, is World Refugee Day, and the United Nations says 70 million people worldwide were forcibly displaced at the end of 2018 by wars, violence, and persecution. Nigeria, for example, hosts about 35,000 refugees who have fled the separatist conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. But as Timothy Obiozu reports from Abuja, a refugee coordinator said the actual number could be twice as many.
46-year-old Ernest Cho was a merchandise trader in Cameroon before he fled the country with his two sons in search of asylum in Nigeria. Cho is among more than 437,000 Cameroonians forcibly displaced by unrest in the southwest and northwest regions of the country. Now he tries to start his life again in Nigeria's capital.
My home in the village, virtually nobody is staying there. We don't have a single life in my house in the village. Everybody has been displaced.
About 35,000 Cameroonian refugees are in Nigeria, according to the UN Refugee Agency and local officials. But refugee advocates say that figure is more than double, an assertion Nigerian immigration authorities, including Sadia Umar, dismiss.
That 5,000 only from Cameroon. But as I mentioned, we have refugees from other parts of the world. So in our records, we do not have 70,000.
Like in many parts of the African continent, Nigeria is affected by internal displacements and the refugee crisis. More than 2 million people north of the country are displaced from their homes and living in makeshift camps because of attacks by militant Islamic groups. Hundreds of others have also sought refuge in Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. UNHCR Nigeria and ECOWAS representative Antonio Yose says returning refugees to their homes will not be easy.
The reason for which they have run away needs to be solved. When you talk, for instance, of Cameroonian refugees, if they feel excluded from the national politics, it is only at the point when the situation in their country that they will be returning.
But unless the political crisis in Cameroon comes to an end, refugees like Ernest Joe would rather be away from home. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Uganda hosts Africa's largest refugee population. 1.25 million and 36,000 of them are unaccompanied and separated children. Refugee families are split by war and conflict and also by poverty and domestic violence. Halima Atumani reports from Adjumani, Uganda, on the plight of children-headed refugee families.
In 2013, 16-year-old Salila Miala's family fled fighting in South Sudan to a refugee camp in Uganda. But 3 years later, her parents returned home, leaving the children in Uganda and Miala as head of the household. I came with my parents, but my father beat my mother, so she left. The United Nations Refugee Agency says more than 36,000 refugee children in Uganda are unaccompanied or separated from their parents. While most broken families were torn apart by years of conflict in South Sudan, domestic violence and poverty also play a role. Mata Bellini is the Associate Protection Officer for the UNHCR.
parents are looking for opportunities around, often, you know, creating tensions within the family. In some cases, you have perhaps, you know, the wife receiving more support, I mean, being able to provide more support than the husband, and that's already a situation of tension in families.
Ugandan authorities say foster parents take care of the unaccompanied or separated children when possible, while authorities search for the parents. But there are also too many child-headed refugee families like Miala's. Uganda Commissioner for Refugees Gerald Menya says parents who abandon children should be dealt with.
Then we take care of them as child-headed families. Yeah, but if they are within the country, the long arm of government always catches up with the parents and they are apprehended and persecuted and also disciplined.
The Ugandan Red Cross last week helped track down Miala's mother in South Sudan, where she had remarried. Abel Nwamanya is the Uganda Red Cross Protection Officer.
We managed to get their contact of their mother, and through their phone call service, we managed to restore the link, the contact between the mother and the children. And also we discovered that the mother now has started sending some assistance to the children.
As for Miala, she looks forward to the day when she can safely return to South Sudan and no longer play the role of both parents for her brothers and sisters. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Adjumani, Uganda.
Sudan protest groups say they plan to march at night in an attempt to pressure the military for a return to civilian rule. Sudan's security forces earlier this month crushed a weeks-long sit-in by protesters, reportedly killing dozens. Naba Muhadin reports from Khartoum.
Sudan protest groups say they will hold night marches in an attempt to reignite momentum to pressure the military for a return to civilian rule. The protest organizer, the SPA, say this step came with others to fill the gap made by Sudan's transitional military council when it blocked the internet for 2 weeks. SPA representative Jafar Hassan says night protests will rebuild the protesters' confidence. He said, "We chose night protests for two reasons. Firstly, because at night people will be free from daily obligations. Night protest is good under these conditions." Hassan says, secondly, to rebuild confidence among protesters. Now streets is ready, he adds. Protesters like Hadi Imad, who survived the deadly breakup of a protest sit-in 2 weeks ago, are not ready to give up. He said it's very obvious the transitional military council is willing to defeat the revolution, starting from breaking up the sit-in and also escalating force. So as protesters, he says, they will fight peacefully with all means. Another protester, Muhammad Yasser, who volunteered as a doctor during Sudan's uprising, thinks protesters feel this is a new revolution. Night protests are now better than daytime ones. It may give a chance to decrease the casualties by spreading security forces, he says. And protesters also need to organize, to make and build confidence. Sudan's demonstrations began in December over bread prices and fuel shortages. Protesters demanded political change and called for then-President Omar al-Bashir to step down. The Transitional Military Council took power when al-Bashir was toppled after 30 years in power. Negotiations between protesters and the council to form a joint military-civilian government came to a halt when the military violently broke up a weeks-long sit-in and killed dozens of protesters Monday. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 20th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Malawi Wednesday elected its first female Speaker of Parliament, Catherine Gotani-Hara of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, joins a small but growing number of women speakers of Parliament. Parliament growing Africa, including South Africa, the Gambia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Gotani's election comes as her party and that of former Vice President Saulos Chilima have gone to court to challenge the results of the May 21st presidential election. In fact, today, Thursday, MCP leader Lazarus Chilima Lasro Chekwera is expected to join a demonstration called by the Human Rights Defenders Coalition to demand the resignation of Malawi Election Commission Chair Jane Ansah. Rafik Hajjad, the executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction, says the election of the new Speaker of Parliament was made possible by the coming together of independents and opposition parties.
Her name is Catherine Gotrani. She's one of the MPs that were elected during the recently ended 2019 tripartite elections. And she's been voted in to Parliament by a fairly narrow margin, but this effectively makes her the third most powerful person in Malawi. It's also interesting that the deputy speaker is also female. So we've got like an all-female team.
And this is the first time that Malawi has had the female speaker of Parliament.
Yes, it is the first time. In South Africa, I think it already has a female speaker, but most of Africa is yet to realize that dream.
The new Speaker of Parliament, she is from the opposition Malawi Congress Party. That's the party of Lazarus Chikwera, is that correct?
That is correct.
So how did she become Speaker? Who has the majority in Parliament?
Well, the DPP has got about 65 or 67 seats. The MCP has got 55. We've got a large independent bloc, which is 55 seats as well. And they, at the moment, hold the power in Parliament, because nothing can pass Parliament without them giving the nod. So effectively, the DPP is in a minority in Parliament.
You know that the results of the 21st May elections are being contested by the Malawi Congress Party leader, Lazarus Chekwera. Could the election of the new Speaker of Parliament be a gesture on the part of the DPP?
I am not sure, but I can tell you that the Speaker, in her first speech, talked about unity. She implored the members of Parliament to rise above partisan interests. She made reference to the toxic environment that is prevailing on the streets. She talked about rising above partisan interests and working towards national unity and national development. She obviously wanted to distance herself from the current tension and the toxic environment that is prevailing on the streets.
A lot is happening. We hear also that President Mutharika has picked his cabinet. Who is in and who is out?
Well, basically, it's pretty much no surprises. It's quite a lean cabinet. I think there's a cabinet of 18 ministers, and I think it's roughly about 11 or 12 deputy ministers. I didn't see any major surprises. The major thing that I noticed was that the Minister of Finance is Joseph Mwanambeka.
Today, Thursday, is also a very important day in Malawi. The Human Rights Defenders Coalition, it's leading a protest today. What can you tell us?
Yes, they're leading a protest demanding, amongst other things, that the chair of the Electoral Commission resign, demanding that the votes that were falsified tally sheets be rescinded and nullified, basically demanding that the elections be deemed null and void.
Do we know if the former Vice President Solos Chilima, is he going to participate in the protest, as he has said, or his party has said?
We hear so, but we will only know tomorrow.
Thank you for speaking to us again.
You're most welcome, James.
Rafik Hajjad is the Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Interaction in Malawi. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Three terrorists have been convicted in Kenya for their role in the 2015 Garissa University attack that killed 148 people. The judge said the three were in communication with the Al-Shabaab group during the attack. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the magistrate let go one of the accused for lack of sufficient evidence.
The three suspects, Muhammad Ali Abdikar, Hassan Eden Hassan, and Rashid Mberesero of Tanzanian origin, were found to be guilty of killing 148 people at the Garissa University on 2nd April 2015. The Nairobi Court Chief Magistrate Francis Andai said that the prosecution has found beyond reasonable doubt that the three were in communication with the terrorist before the attack.
I'm satisfied that the incident that took place at the Garissa University College on the morning of 2nd April 2015 bore all the above elements of a terrorist. terrorist act. Jointly with Abdirahim Mohammed Abdullahi, deceased, Khalid Isaac Hassan, deceased, and other persons not before court, conspired to commit a terrorist act at Garissa University College. I find no basis to hold that the accused persons have been embarrassed or prejudiced, because that is what should come out clearly.
And I, however, acquitted all the charges against one of the suspects, Hassan Dirie, for lack of enough evidence. He says the suspect's presence in the company of the accused persons is not evident enough to link him to the killings.
The most remarkable and heartrending are those showing bodies of students, young souls whose pursuit for education at the university cost them their lives, neatly arranged after they were brutalized by the attackers through the barrel of the deadly rifles. They are also shown bodies of the four attackers, the ammunition sheathed on their bodies, testimony to the deadly mission they were out for and which they had indeed accomplished. The only reason for his arrest was that he was alleged to have been in company of the first accused person.
Over 20 witnesses testified in the case, among them students and experts. Speaking outside the courtroom, one of the witnesses said that public learning institutions should be safe for all the students.
To invest in a child, especially for a girl, to change the community, then to vanish without anything. She was not ill, no information, nothing. You do not suspect of such a thing. Dying in the hands of the government institution, it's very painful.
The three will be sentenced on 3rd of July this year. All the four gunmen who attacked the students were killed by security forces. Kenya has been targeted for long by the militia group Al-Shabaab, as 5 days ago, 8 police officers were killed after the vehicle they were traveling in ran over an improvised explosive device. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The East African Legislative Assembly has named senior East African officials who should face disciplinary measures and actions for allegations of corruption and fund mismanagement. This comes as the community is facing delays in remittances of contributions from partner states. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
In a 161-page report presented by the Accounts Committee to the Regional Assembly, lawmakers disclosed the names of senior officials accused of mismanaging the community's fund. Ngwaru Magembe is the chairman of the Audit Committee.
The committee recommends to the Assembly to request the Council of Ministers to institute disciplinary measures in accordance with Regulation 88-29E for breach of the EAC rules and regulations to the following officers of the community: the Secretary General, the Ambassador Liberat Mfumukeko, Counsel to the Community, Dr. Kafumbe Anthony, Director of Finance, Mr. Juvenal Ndimuriru.
However, the Counsel to the Community, Anthony Kafumbe, was against naming the individuals.
The report mentions names. People are never given an opportunity to defend themselves. The Audit Commission, yes, audits, they audit systems and propose improvements. They don't audit and say so-and-so is responsible.
Among the senior East African Community officials named in the report included the former and the current Secretary General, Deputy Secretary Generals, and procurement officers. This is the first time that the audit report directly named the officials. Dennis Namara is a lawmaker from Uganda.
We were given clear instructions that we want this report to mention the people who are capable. So we followed the Other Powers and Privileges Act, the financial rules and regulations, whereby culpability is individual, not on a system.
According to the report, nearly $1 million was unaccounted for in the payroll. Another $537,000 was lost as a result of illegal contracts. The report indicated officials awarded contracts to companies without any competition and relocating funds of about $1.3 million from the personnel emolument account. Contrary to the regulations, Mary Mugenyi is a lawmaker from Uganda.
I think that it is important for us to set a precedent. The concern is, how do we make sure that people fear to do wrong things?
The audit report comes in a period when the community is facing financial challenges due to the delays in remittances of contributions from the partner states. As the report was approved by the regional parliament, it is expected for the Council of Ministers now to take punitive measures against the accused officials. Moses Javier Imana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
Winnie Cyrano reports from Juba, South Sudan, on how the availability of sanitary pads is helping to keep young girls in school.
17-year-old Atong Thonbo says she was given 6 reusable sanitary towels by a group of mentors who visited St. Kizito Primary School in Epo. She says the mentors told girls how to use the pads and how to clean them. Speaking in Arabic, Atong says she used to sell fruits in the market in order to earn money to buy menstrual products, but now can spend her money on other basic necessities since receiving the free reusable pads.
It has helped me a lot because my parents used not to buy for me pads. I'm the one who hustled by myself so as to buy pads. When I get some money, I use it to buy. And the pads they gave us help until the future.
Speaking in Arabic, 17-year-old Wilma Peter, another pupil at St. Kizito Primary School, says she used to miss school whenever her periods came, but since receiving the 6 free pads, she never misses school.
At that time, at times there is no money. When I ask my parents, they do not give me. So at times I do not come to school because if I come to school, my uniform will get dirty, which is not good. So I will stay at home. Once I finish my period, I come back to school.
17-year-old St. Kizito student Josephine Adia says her parents would occasionally give her some money for pads, but she would often use it to buy other essentials like underwear. Speaking in Arabic, Josephine says a packet of sanitary pads in the market costs 300 South Sudanese pounds, an amount she cannot afford to pay every month.
The one from the market, at times when you buy one packet, will get finished during that one period session. And the next time you see your period, you have to buy another packet. It is expensive.
Gira Betty, a senior woman at Darling Wisdom Nursery and Primary School, says some girls leave school when they see their periods coming and only return days later.
We lack sanitary pants in our school and other things that cannot make them to be in the school when they have the menstruation periods.
Every so often, the school provides sanitary towels and panties to the girls in an emergency, and female instructors explain menstruation to girls so they don't panic once they experience it, according to Betty. Yawa Simon, the supervisor at H&J Company, says she and 20 other women were trained by Titi Foundation, a local NGO that supports women and girls with sanitary towels. She says the company produces reusable sanitary towels and distributes them freely to girls to encourage them to stay in school. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Today, Thursday, is World Refugee Day, and the United Nations says 70 million people worldwide were forcibly displaced at the end of 2018 by wars, violence, and persecution. Nigeria, for example, hosts about 35,000 refugees who have fled the separatist conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. Malawi Wednesday elected its first female Speaker of Parliament, Catherine Gotani Hara, of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party. She joins a small but growing number of women Speaker of Parliament around Africa, including South Africa, the Gambia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Gotani's election comes as her party and that of former Vice President Saulos Chilima have gone to court to challenge the results of the May 21st presidential election. In fact, today, Thursday, the party leader, Lazarus Chilima, is expected to join a demonstration called by the Human Rights Defenders Coalition to demand the resignation of Malawi Election Commission Chair, Jean Ansah. That is it for this Thursday, June 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Van Dyke, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa.
Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.